is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Schools can build whatever facilities they want. They can pay coaches whatever they want. They can pay any non-athlete whatever they want. They can spend whatever they want on travel. They can feed the players whatever they want. The only spending control there is on players. And in a multi-billion dollar business like this, I don't think that's fair or right. And I think it's wrong to the point of being immoral.
Jay Billis, ESPN college basketball analyst, is known for his extensive knowledge of men's basketball and insightful analysis about the sports industry. Billis, who is featured on ESPN's Game and Studio coverage, calls the top men's college basketball games involving the nation's marquee teams and conferences. Since 2003, Jay has provided in-depth player scouting and analysis for ESPN's coverage of the NBA draft. A prep All-American from Los Angeles, California, the 6'7 Billis was a four-year starter at Duke under Mike Krzyzewski from 1982 to 1986. As an undersized center, Billis scored 1,062 points, grabbed 692 rebounds, and helped lead Duke to the 1986 ACC Championship and the NCAA Championship game. Drafted by the NBA's Dallas Mavericks, Billis played professional basketball overseas, ranking among the league's top scorers in Italy during the 1987 and 88 seasons, and then in Spain for part of the 1989 season. Billis then returned to Duke in 1990 to serve as an assistant coach on Krzyzewski's staff, while also earning his law degree from Duke Law School. As an assistant coach under Coach K, the Blue Devils advanced to the NCAA Championship game three times, winning back-to-back titles in 1991 and 1992. After you're done listening to this episode with Jay Billis, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes, and make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. The Hoopheads Pod can be found on all the major podcast apps. Let a friend or coaching colleague know about the show, so we can continue to grow the great game of basketball. Get ready to learn from one of the best minds in the game as we sit down for a wide-ranging conversation with ESPN college basketball analyst Jay Billis. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And today we are pleased to welcome to the podcast ESPN college basketball analyst Jay Billis. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
No, thank you guys for having me. It's a pleasure.
We are really excited to be able to sit down with you, talk a little basketball, and learn more about your journey and how you got to the point where you are now, your camp, and all the great things that you're doing at ESPN. So I want to start out, though, Jay, by going back in time to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about some of your first experiences in the game of basketball and kind of how you fell in love with the game as a young kid.
Well, like most kids, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and I played junior basketball when I was in fourth grade. I think my mom, wanted me out of the house, so she saw an ad in the paper for our local basketball league. It was called the Rolling Hills Intermediate Basketball League, and so she took me up and dropped me off at tryouts, and I tried out, and I had very little experience other than playing with my friends. And I made a team that was called the conference team. So each grade had its own travel team, and without having ever done it before, I made the conference team. So I never really played at the local high school league where, you know, the Celtics played the Sixers on Saturday or whatever. We traveled around all over Southern California and Nevada every weekend. And so I probably played 50 games a year. From fourth grade through eighth grade, played with the same guys every year that ultimately became our high school team. And, you know, so that's sort of how I got into it. And as soon as I started playing, I loved it, man. I couldn't get enough of it. And it was so competitive. And, you know, it seemed like we were playing in a tournament every, at least one, maybe two or three tournaments every weekend. So we played a bunch and it was just fun. Like the parents weren't really involved. My mom and dad, I was parented, but I wasn't supervised. You know, back then your parents weren't worried about you getting snatched off the street.
They, right, exactly.
You know, they figured if somebody took you, they'd bring you back. And then 5 minutes later, going, geez, I don't want this kid. So, you know, we ran around on our own, and my parents didn't come to a lot of my games when I was growing up because I had other siblings, and so I was kind of on my own playing. It was my own thing, and I loved it.
I think it's cool that you played a lot with the kids that you ended up playing high school basketball with, because that's something that I experienced that as well. Like from the time I was probably in, I don't know, fourth or fifth grade, I felt like I kind of knew who the guys were going to be
that I was going to play high school basketball with. And obviously today's system is a little bit different. How much basketball did you play outside of organized basketball and finding games on the playground and playing pickup? Because that's one of the things that I'd like to get your opinion on, is just the fact that kids today don't have, one, they don't have the same opportunities, because I think you hit the nail on the head. We all parent differently now than we did. And so when I was 13 or 14, I was heading all over the city trying to find games or riding along with older guys that had cars that could get me to different games all over the place. And so how would you describe the amount of pickup basketball that you played compared to maybe what a kid in the system today plays?
I played pickup 3, 4, maybe 5 nights a week. We would go to different high schools or different gyms, playgrounds around the city. Sometimes we would drive a half an hour, whatever it was, to get there. And same kind of thing, you know, somebody would drive, I would drive, whatever, when I was old enough. So we played all the time, and our coaches complained that we played too much pickup ball. You know, now they complain they don't play enough. So, I mean, I know there's a balance to everything, but, players don't do that anymore. And I don't know that it's better or worse. I think the players today are better than ever, but I'm not sure that they're, that some of them are as competition savvy as players were years ago. They're more skilled and they're more athletic. They're better in almost every way. But, you know, like when my son was coming up, he just graduated from college just a month ago. But when he was coming up, you know, I don't know how much game point basketball he played on the playgrounds. He didn't do it very much. I did it a lot. You know, it's just it was a different world back then. So I don't know that it's necessarily better, because all I know is our coaches complained like crazy about how much pickup we played. And now coaches complain that they don't play enough pickup. So, I just don't know where the right balance is.
Yeah. There's probably a balance somewhere in between the two systems, I think, where it would be the best for players. 'Cause I do think that you made the point of players today being much more skilled. And I think that's definitely true. I think especially if you look at an average high school team, you look at the players who make up sort of the end of the bench, those players are way more skilled than players in the era when you and I were playing high school basketball, where player 10, 11, and 12 might have been a football kid who just set screens and rebounded. And whereas I think now those kids have kind of been almost pushed out of the game because everybody's training and doing all these things that enable them to develop their skill. And yet I still feel like, to your point, that pickup basketball affords you opportunities to play against people of different ages. So a lot of times if you're a 14, 15 year old kid and you're playing against a 22 year old, or you're playing against an adult, even that adult may not be that skilled of a player. They're still bigger and more physical and more experienced than you are. And I think you learn things from that. So it's definitely, I think if we could find a balance between the two systems, we would be much better off. So I want to get to a story that John Searby told when he was on the podcast, and I want to get it from your perspective about your take on the current AAU system and how that led to the genesis of you starting your skills camp down in North Carolina. Can you talk a little bit about what prompted you to come up with the idea for, I want to do the Jay Billis skills camp? Talk about how that came to be.
Well, John and I started coaching an AAU team together, and it really stemmed from my wife not really caring for the way the players were being treated by the coaches that were, you know, running some of the AAU teams that we were watching. And it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't that they were abusive or anything. It's just, you know, she felt like it wasn't the right thing for our kid and for some other kids that we knew. And so she asked me to get involved. So we basically started kind of our own AAU team, if you will. And John and I coached it. And I didn't know John before. He was approached by a friend of mine who approached me and got us together. And I liked John from the first minute. You know, we sat down, we kind of talked, how do we want to do this? And we were basically, look, I'm not interested in yelling at these guys. Let's teach them, you know, what we think is the right way to play. We're not going to say a word to an official. You know, we'll make this a good experience for the players and for us. And we did that. But when I got out there and I had been flying around to 30,000 feet watching, you know, the top prospects play in the biggest gyms. And So I wasn't in the side gym seeing all this stuff. And I kind of said to John, I mean, my God, is it all like this? And he basically said, yeah, pretty much. And he said, it might be actually be worse than this. We're in a pretty good spot here. And I didn't like it. I didn't care for it. Not that all of it was bad. There were a lot of it that was good, but it just sort of, it's almost like I was overwhelmed by how much was coming at me at one time. And, you know, guys walking up saying, hey, you know, in our program, we do this. And I'm looking at him going, your program, what are you talking about? I mean, you got an AAU team. It's not a program. and you know, guys scouting and all this stuff. And I'm like, geez, talk about over the top. But when John and I were talking, because we share a lot of views about the game and how things are going, and John had a profound influence on me. He basically said, look, we can't fix this ourselves, but we can make a difference in our own backyard. And if you want to do that, there are a couple ways we can do it. And I really was moved by that, sort of the idea that, you know what, we can make things a little bit better where we live. So let's do that. And we started the camp and wanted to make it kind of an old school concept, but account for the way things are now. And we feel like we've done that. And, you know, we try to teach the players and coach the coaches and do it, you know, only have skilled, experienced coaches that have been head coaches and know what they're doing and are in it for the right reasons or what we think are the right reasons. And it's been a rewarding experience. We've had a great time. And all we really want to do is, you know, somebody helped us, we want to help somebody else. And all these guys, you know, they may not wind up being college or pro players, but they a lot of them can stay in the game and have a positive impact on those that come after them. And that's sort of all we're trying to do.
I think if you can use the game to make that positive impact on kids, and so much of what we see, and we could probably get into this too, is you see a lot of things being catered to those top 100 players, or the top 200 players, or whatever the case may be. And you see everybody else just kind of gets shoved down into this mix of who knows what when you're in the AAU system. So can you talk a little bit about, I think one of the things that I found that makes your camp very unique is the coaching piece of it. So not only do you have the traditional model where the kids are there and you're giving your skill instruction and they're playing in games and they're doing all the things that are good for player development, but talk a little bit about the coaching development piece, both the coaches development program, and then I know you added the coaches leadership program. Talk a little bit about those two things, because that's something that I think is very unique that maybe the average person, again, doesn't know when it comes to hearing about what you're doing with your camp.
Well, we bring the players in. We try to educate them as best we can, both on the floor with how to play and then off the floor with how to conduct themselves, how to be a great teammate, how to deal with the people that are around there, around the university where we hold our camp. So their interactions with the staff there, with the food service professionals, the people that are doing maintenance, all that. And then we also, we only have Division II, Division III head coaches and former Division I head coaches that staff the camp. So those are the people that are in charge of the players' development on and off the floor and in charge of their staffs. And we also have, you know, we've got educational programs for coaches. So there are a lot of young coaches, whether they be high school coaches, maybe a college manager, Division I manager that wants to get into coaching that has a lot of practical knowledge about the game, but not a lot of practical experience. So we bring them in and they serve on the staffs of the head coaches. So there are probably about 50 of coaches development program coaches. So each staff, each team, and we break the players into teams. They don't, you know, they do drills in the morning and then they play in the afternoon and evening. But they have a staff of like five or six coaches for each team. So the player to coach ratio is really good. It's probably two players per coach, which is, I don't know if anybody's got it better, but we got a lot.
And, that's for sure.
And then they're either on the floor with the players or they are in a classroom getting educated. They get USA Basketball certified. Don Showalter from USA Basketball comes in and puts on a great program. We bring in a bunch of college coaches that do presentations, both X and O wise and character. We bring in people that will educate them on compliance, on ethics. So we're trying to give them a comprehensive view of what it's like to be a coach and what they need to know. And hopefully they leave USA Basketball certified, gold certified, after the 4-day program. And then this year, for the first time, we brought in about a dozen Division I assistant coaches and gave them education and training on how to be a head coach. And we had athletic directors that came in and spoke. We had media training. The athletic directors not only did a panel with the coaches, but they had breakout sessions where they actually did mock interviews and they interviewed them for head coaching positions. And then we had a bunch of Division I coaches come in and speak to them and as part of their education and training. And it really turned out to be, I think, a positive experience for everyone, myself included. I sat in on it. This is the first year that I didn't spend every minute on the floor with the players because we had so many programs going on that I felt I needed to be, upstairs in a classroom for at least an hour, stuff like that. And then we also have parental programs where, like you had mentioned before, when we were kids, if you went to a camp or something, your parents dropped you off and they went home. Now the parents come to the camp and they stay every minute. So we give the parents recruiting education, compliance training, all that stuff. So they have a better idea of what's coming at them while they're having to make a decision on what the best environment is for their son going forward. So in this case, their son, because it's a boys camp. It's been a really rewarding experience. There's a lot going on, but it's an intense period. But it's proven to be a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, I can imagine that it's a lot of fun for you to be able to see where you guys started from and what it's turned into. And the fact that not only are you able to impact players, which I think was probably your initial vision, correct?
Yeah, it's the first thing we thought of. But after we realized, hey, there's a need for this and there are so many coaches, we started thinking about, wait a minute now, who do we want? We were the ones saying that we weren't crazy about the system and how do we train coaches to do a better job or the best possible job? It's not that coaches don't do a good job, but you don't have to have any certification or training to hang a whistle around your neck and be in charge of the basketball development of young people. And so we thought, hey, we can make an impact here and help young people get a leg up and getting into the game. And it's turned out to be maybe the most rewarding part of the entire program that we run is the coaches development and the coaches leadership program.
Yeah, I think the opportunity to bring in all those different coaches and give them the opportunity to be educated. And just I can speak to the quality of the people that came in that you put in front of all those coaches was just tremendous. And I think anybody that I talked to walked away from that experience just raving about not only the people that they ended up meeting that were part of the camp itself, but then those speakers that came in that shared their time and were willing to give of themselves and be that servant leader that we all talk about, I think just provided all those coaches there with just invaluable amounts of information to take back to, whether that was their high school or their college or whatever it was. And I really enjoyed it. I didn't get to sit down on every coach's leadership program, but I definitely sat in on a couple of them, and that I thought was tremendous. I can't even imagine the value that those coaches, leadership guys walked away from. I mean, I probably had a conversation with, I would guess, out of the 10 or 11 that were there, I had a pretty good conversation with 4 or 5. They all just walked away raving with what they were able to get out of that and how they felt it was going to really help them going forward in their career. So I think that's something that you guys are definitely going to, I'm sure, build on and continue to grow, and it's going to continue to get better and better and better. So I'm sure you're excited about that and that it got off to such a great start this year.
Yeah, we were very pleased. I wasn't sure what to expect from the coach's leadership piece of it, but it not surprisingly, with the crew that we have that are, as you mentioned, so selfless and wanting to give back. To have John Shulman, who's now the head coach at Alabama Huntsville, just got that job recently when it became open, when Lenny Acuff went to Lipscomb, he does such a great job of asking coaches to come in, and all of them say yes. They want to give back and help the younger people that are trying to get in this because somebody helped them. So I've been gratified by that whole program. Thank you for saying that. And hopefully, we'll continue to get so many quality people in. And it's been a real blessing for all of us.
Yeah, I can only imagine. One of the stories that you shared with the coaches during the camp was about your experience with, quote unquote, showing up and how important it is to show up and be somewhere. And that sometimes is enough to give you an opportunity to shine and get somebody to notice you. And you talked a little bit about a meeting that you had at ESPN that kind of catapulted you towards the direction that you've eventually headed in your career. Can you talk a little bit about that experience that you had in that meeting and what that enabled you to do and how it launched you towards the position that you've been able to get to with ESPN at this point?
I told the story about when I was first really getting going in broadcasting. It was 1998, and I was assigned as a sideline reporter to the Duke Carolina game. So Dick Vitale and I think it was Brad Nessler were doing the game, and I was a sideline guy. And so there was a big production meeting. It was the first college game that was going to go on ESPN2, I believe. And so it was a big rollout for ESPN. So we had a lot of our bosses there, and there was a gigantic production meeting the morning of the game. And I really wasn't expected to be at the meeting. And so I found out about the meeting, and I asked my boss, "Hey, you know, do you need me there?" And he said, "Well, we don't need you there, but if you'd like to go." And Vitale had something else going on, so he couldn't make the meeting. And so I went and I was listening, and somebody had mentioned that, well, you know, we've decided that we're going to showcase Shimon Williams as the player to watch in the game. And my boss kind of asked me, what do you think? And I said, well, I think that's fine, but I'm more drawn to Antoine Jameson. I think he's the real story in the game. And I basically talked about how I'd never seen a player that was quicker to the catch, off the catch to the release than he was. That, you know, he's so productive without having the ball in his hands for very long. He doesn't play with the ball. He doesn't mess around with it. He just does his work early and catches it, gets rid of it. My boss had never really heard that before. And said, well, how would we show that? Like, how would we demonstrate that? And I suggested, well, if you've got somebody that we could dedicate to it, give him a stopwatch and have him hit the stopwatch every time he catches it and hit it again every time he releases the ball. But just don't count free throws where, you know, it's going to be in his hands for a long period of time, which isn't game action. Or I don't think it should count if he's the inbound guy, you know, but everything else where it's on court action, just hit it. So, you know, luckily kind of worked out. So it turned out that he had 35 points, 11 rebounds, and had the ball in his hands for only 53 seconds. And my bosses kind of looked at me after that, like, well, you know, you're not an idiot. That was and it was all because I showed up at something. And it wasn't so much that it you know, helped my career, which it did, because at least my bosses knew I, you know, maybe it felt I was paying attention to what the hell was going on. But it was more the thing of being there to help make the broadcast better, or, you know, try be there. If they're having a meeting, be there. And look, if I couldn't be there, that's one thing. Some people couldn't be there. Their schedules didn't allow it. That's fine. I wasn't expected to be there, but I wasn't doing anything else. So why not go? You know, it's amazing what can happen when you show up. And I showed up. Things worked out. Now, it could have been that Jameson had a bad game. That happens, you know, or that he had the ball, that the numbers didn't work out in that game. But it demonstrated the point we were trying to make, and it wound up being a good moment for the broadcast, and certainly a nice moment for me. And it was all just because I showed up.
Yeah, I think there's a great lesson there to be learned, that a lot of times, if you just get an opportunity and you make the most of that opportunity by being where you're supposed to be, or even in your case, being somewhere where maybe you weren't required to be, but you put in that little bit of extra time, that little bit of extra effort that makes you stand out from the crowd. And I think that's something that if we could get that across to all the young people that we touch as coaches, I think we could make the basketball world and the greater world itself much, much better.
Well, that's a good point. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you mentioned opportunity, some people say that opportunity knocks, but I don't think it does knock. I think you have to knock and open that door. And that's part of the showing up thing. Like if I waited for somebody to invite me, you know, to the meeting that day, you know, maybe I don't have that opportunity. Opportunity wasn't going to knock. You know, I asked if I could go. And that wound up, you know, being a nice thing and a lucky thing. But if you're waiting for opportunity to knock, you know, sometimes it doesn't always knock. You gotta do the knocking yourself.
That's for sure. You definitely have to go out there and stick your neck out and be willing to put yourself out there. If you're not willing to put yourself out there, it becomes much more difficult for great things to happen for you versus where you're out there and you're talking to people and you're willing to extend and go that extra mile for somebody or do something to help them. Ultimately, you're doing a great thing for the people that you're helping, but in a lot of cases, it ends up circling back to you and you end up benefiting yourself. So I think that there's a great lesson to be learned for sure from that story. Can you talk a little bit, Jay, about how and why you decided to go into broadcasting and just kind of that genesis of how you went from doing what you've been doing previously? You know, you got to play a little bit of professional basketball and then you were working as a lawyer and you were thinking about doing some acting. And so talk a little about how you ended up getting into broadcasting and how that transition happened.
Well, when I left college, I played pro ball and I got drafted by the Dallas Mavericks and I went to camp and then I wound up getting a really good offer to play in Italy. So I played overseas for a few years and my coach, Coach K, my college coach, offered me a position on his staff when it became open. And I sort of thought, well, I really do want to get in coaching. It's a pretty good opportunity to start a coaching career, at Duke, which is a pretty good leg up. So I took it. I was a grad assistant at Duke for 3 years. I got admitted to law school. And so I wound up doing both at the same time. And it was really a good thing that I did. And I was grateful to Coach K and still am that he sort of made that available to me. But after 3 years of it, I got married. My wife and I kind of decided that, coaching may not be the best thing for us as a family, so I had other things I could do. So I started my law practice and started doing broadcast work on the side. And I did it mostly for fun. I started doing radio games and, I worked at it and one thing led to another and ESPN started offering me games. And it became after about 7-8 years of practicing law full time and then doing broadcast work on the side, it became too difficult to do both. So I had to choose and I chose broadcasting. I'm still with my law firm. I don't practice anymore full time, but my license is still active and I can practice. I just don't. But I was fortunate that I could make basketball a career on the broadcast side. And I feel like outside of my law practice, I've never really worked a day in my life in basketball. So I've been really lucky. And when you get to do something that you really enjoy, it doesn't feel like work. The only thing that's work for me is travel. That's the only thing that makes any part of this feel like work is when I'm on the road a lot. Because it takes you away from, sort of family moments. But all in all, I've probably been home more for more quality time as a broadcaster than I would have been if I'd been a full-time lawyer and slept at home every night. I would have been getting home a lot later. I know that.
Yeah, absolutely. How many days a year are you on the road?
I'm afraid to count because it would be too depressing, but it's a lot. And, it's, my wife's been great, with it. She helps keep everything balanced and make sure that I don't say yes to too many things. And, our kids are 24 and 22 now, so they're pretty much out of that. Well, they are out of the house. So that's, now it's just, my wife can come with me a little bit more when I travel the places she'd like to go. So that's a nice thing for me to have her along. But, I think for anybody that has to travel a little bit, you have to be really mindful that you make sure you get to the really important stuff and that when you are home, that you're mentally and emotionally present. You're not thinking about something else because being away takes its toll on everybody, you included, but more so on your family.
Yeah, I think anybody who has a job that requires them to be away from home, whether that's just because they work long hours or because they travel. I think that's one of the challenges that we all face in our careers is, we're ambitious, we want to do great things, and yet you have to strike that balance between what you want to do professionally and what your family needs from you at home. And obviously, we all try to eventually reach the conclusion that, our family takes precedent, and sometimes it has to take a back seat just because of the requirements of what it is that we're doing. But for the most part, it's something that we have to really make sure that you made a great point about being present when you're present so that you give your family the full and complete attention when you're around. So obviously the travel is a downside of the broadcasting. What is it that you love about what you do now? What's your favorite part of doing what you do?
Being courtside and being at games and practices, and I've learned so much about basketball through this part of the job. you know, I learned, I had a great foundation in the game from, you know, from the guy that I learned from when I was in fourth through eighth grade. And then through Coach K, and then some of the people I played for, you know, in Europe, and you know, I played for Gene Cady on the U.S. national team, stuff like that. So I had a really good basketball education before I got into broadcasting. But being in broadcasting, I get to sit in on meetings and practices and film sessions of the best coaches in the world, and so I've learned a ton, and it's been a different ways than I was taught. And that's been really, really helpful for me. I think if I ever did get into coaching again, which I won't, but if I ever did, I'd be a hell of a lot better coach, you know, after all this broadcast work than I would have been otherwise, just because I've seen so many things. But that's the most fun is, and you know, I think for the same reason people enjoy going to sporting events and they really, you know, it's fun for them. When that's your job, that's a pretty good gig. So I've rarely ever complained about my job. You know, kind of like I said before, travel is the only thing that is any sort of work. And, you know, Hubert Davis, who I worked with for a number of years, now an assistant coach at North Carolina. When he took the North Carolina job, I was saying, geez, you're going to be on the road a lot more. And he said, no, I'm actually going to be on the road less. and he said, you're forgetting one thing. He says, in broadcasting, every game is an away game. He says, half my games are going to be home games. So I'm going to be home more than you're going to be home. And I started really thinking about it, and he was right.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned that by getting an opportunity to go and attend all these practices, attend these different games, and kind of get the behind-the-scenes look at all these different ways that coaches do things. One of the things that I always found to be interesting, or I thought about when I was playing, is you kind of are insulated in that when you're a player, you only kind of see the program that you're in. You only see, in your case, you only see what Mike Krzyzewski does at Duke. You don't necessarily know what is going on at a practice at Clemson or what's going on at a practice at North Carolina. So if you think back to when you first started to get that kind of access as a broadcaster and you got exposed to more than just the Duke program, was there anything that surprised you or was new or interesting that you said, wow, I never thought that this would be going on, or just a different way of approaching the game of basketball? Is there anything that sticks out to you that was different from what you had experienced as a player that you got to see when you got that behind the scenes access?
Oh, all kinds of different things. So, you know, different ways of that coaches approach their craft, different ways they reach players. Some are very, some have positive reinforcement and are others are negative reinforcement and yellers and screamers and, you know, sort of motivators in that way. Some motivate by fear. Some are cajolers. So they just have different personalities, and all of them work. You know, different ways that player or that coaches approach drill work and skill development. And, you know, it's not all the same. And there were a lot of different ways of playing and different strategies that I was exposed to. And, you know, it's one thing when you watch a team on film and say, okay, here's what they do. It's another when you get behind the scenes and you see exactly the theories behind what they implement and how they do it and how they teach it. And why they use it, whether it's Boeheim's zone or, you know, Bruce Pearl and how he defends that, you know, out of bounds underneath, or all these different things that you see that you're going, you know what, if I ever had a team, that's what I'd want to do in this area of the game. This is the way I'd want to teach, you know, approach rebounding or the way North Carolina develops their big guys with their skill work, all kinds of things that were incredibly eye-opening and remain so, because the game's always evolving and always changing. So things that are being taught now weren't necessarily being taught 20 years ago. So it's a constant learning process, and it's been really rewarding and fun to see.
I think finding out that why behind the strategies that you see coaches use, and you may be watching a game and see something new, but to be able to be behind the scenes and see the actual teaching points that are being made when a coach is demonstrating that for their team and they're working on it, that's got to be incredibly interesting to be able to see and pick the minds and watch and see those guys work behind the scenes. Because there just isn't very many people who get that kind of access to all different types of teams. And to be able to see that, it's got to be incredibly, you know, incredibly satisfying to be able to see. I want to start to wrap up, Jay, by asking you about two topics that are sort of relevant in today's basketball world. And the first one is one that I know you've talked about a lot and that is very near and dear to your heart. And that is the need slash desire to compensate college athletes. And so can you talk a little bit about your position on that and why you feel so strongly that there should be pay for athletes who are part of CAA Division I programs?
Yeah, I don't mean to parse words with you here, but I don't feel that there's a need to pay or athletes should be paid. I think that they should be allowed. I think it should be allowed if a school wishes to provide, wants to pay an athlete. Just like, there are no spending controls. The NCAA has no spending control over anything. So schools can build whatever facilities they want. They can pay coaches whatever they want. They can pay any non-athlete whatever they want. They can spend whatever they want on travel. They can feed the players whatever they want. The only spending control there is on players. And in a multi-billion dollar business like this, I don't think that's fair or right. And I think it's wrong to the point of being immoral. I think if you can sell these players for billions of dollars and everybody else has the capability of getting rich off this, including baseball coaches that are, college baseball coaches, they're over a dozen of them that are making more than Major League Baseball managers make. And, how can we justify that and call this amateur sports? It's not amateur. It's professional. So my thing is, let the players, we know this is pro sports. So let the players, let the schools and players contract with each other the way they like and not worry about this and try to make the players out to be criminals and the coaches to be criminals. I'm not suggesting that coaches and players break rules. I still think rules are rules. You have to abide by them. But I'm talking about policy and changing rules. And I don't buy these arguments that somehow, the entire balance of power shifts if players get more into scholarship. I think that's absurd and proven so because, the top programs are getting the best players now because of what they can spend, in facilities and the like. And my belief is why should we spend all this money recruiting players by building these facilities to attract them when it can be much more straightforward and let's just pay the talent we want, what you want, and the market will figure it out just as it does with literally everything else.
It's definitely, I think, the system has been in place for so long that people are worried that you get away from this amateurism. But as you said, I think that we're a long way when you look at the billion-dollar contracts that the NCAA has signed for the college football playoffs and for the NCAA tournament. It's hard to make the argument that there isn't money there to provide something for athletes who are essentially the labor market that all of this business is built on. So I would agree with you that I think there's an opportunity for athletes to be able to earn something beyond their scholarship. One final question to wrap up, Jay, just want to get your opinion about the one and done rule for college basketball in the NBA and just see where you stand on what do you think is the ideal scenario for allowing players to transition from their amateur career into professional basketball. What do you think is the best system? If you could just kind of wave a magic wand and make it the best system you could, what system do you think would be best?
Well, it's a difficult question. It depends on are we going to, bring the NBA into it? Because the best thing to do if we really believe in education would be to keep the players in school longer.
Right.
And so, I think the best thing for the NBA is for them to draft players after their senior year of college. But that's never going to happen. It's just unrealistic. What I think is the NBA should do whatever is in its best interest. If they want to draft high school players, draft high school players. I don't care. They should do whatever they want. I'm not sitting here worried about whether some kid plays professional tennis when they're 14 or, whether they swim in the Olympics when they're 9. That's up to them. But it's up to the NBA what they do. And so wherever they want to draft, go ahead. My thing is with colleges. The NCAA needs to do what's in the best interest of college. And if they're really going to run this multi-billion dollar business, they need to attract players to play and make the case that you should be here rather than put up a stop sign and say, hey, if you don't want to be Bill Bradley or Shane Battier, then screw you, go pro. which is essentially what they're saying. And I think that's very dismissive of their product. And, you know, if we believe in education, why would we ever put up a stop sign to anybody that wants to be in college? I think that's absurd. And what difference does it make if they want to come for a year, two or three? The fallacy of the one and done issue is that, you know, the NCAA is making it seem like once players are allowed to go out of high school, that all the one and done problems go away, and they don't. We're still going to have players that are going to reclass, like RJ Barrett and Marvin Bagley before him. And there are numerous others that come to college early. And so they're only in college for a year and then go. So what problem do we solve by letting him go out of high school? No, we don't solve that problem. You still have Trey Young's still going to leave after 1 year. And what difference does it make if a guy leaves after 1 year or 2 years? They still don't have to take one class toward a major. What difference does it make? You know, if we really believe in education, we should be welcoming players into college to establish a relationship with a school where they're more likely to come back. They're more likely to stay if they're there in the first place. And they're more likely to pursue their education beyond, you know, if they go pro after a year or two. So I think that's all a good thing. I think it's good for Zion Williamson to have been in college for a year. Now, reasonable minds can differ. But my argument is, if you don't want a one and done player, don't recruit them. It's pretty simple. And if you do, go ahead, recruit them all you want to. Duke and Kentucky and some other places have had a number of one and dones, and the world's still spinning on its axis and everything's fine. You know, our problems that we've been facing the last couple of years have stemmed not from anything other than our ridiculous rules of having professional sports, professional basketball with high school. That's why we have these problems. You know, if we really wanted to run an amateur game, then we wouldn't be selling it for billions of dollars and putting it on television like we are. People act like this is the Little League World Series or something, where somebody's dad is coaching the team while he's an insurance salesman the rest of the year. You know, if I had told people when I was in school that someday my coach is going to make $10 million a year coaching college basketball, they'd have said, "You're crazy. That'll never happen. We would never support that. That's not what this is about." And it's happening. And billions of dollars are being generated. And they act like these players now are Little League players, that, boy, you let them have a nickel and all of a sudden the world is going to come to an end, a rapid end, and global warming is going to, you know, going to take over, and every, you know, everything's going to end. And it's absurd. And, you know, these guys are adults, and they should be allowed compensation for what they do, just like literally everybody else. There's no student. No non-athlete student is told what they can earn or accept while they're in school. And that should tell everybody all they need to know, that if somebody else, whether you're an actor or a writer or a musician, you can be in school on a music scholarship and you can cut a record and sell, perform, do whatever you want, make as much money as you want, but you can't do it if you're an athlete. That strikes me as being absurd.
Yeah, I agree. That makes no sense. And I think you could boil down every argument and just bring that to the point, and I think you'd have a pretty good case for allowing athletes to be compensated. And then I love the other thing that you said about the fact that you want guys, if you're the college system, you want players to come in and be part of the college system because you believe in education. You believe in what the mission of your institution is, which is to educate and prepare people for going out and being productive members of society. And so if we could get more players to be involved with that, that would be tremendous. And yet at the same time, I think you don't want to prevent guys who want to go directly to the NBA. They should probably be allowed to do that as well. So I think you make a ton of great points there. Jay, we want to wrap up and be respectful of your time. We can't thank you enough for being willing to jump on with us today. It's been a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you.
Thank you.
To everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.